And we're very lucky and very blessed to have with us here this evening Bhikkhuni Upekkha, a real live Bhikkhuni. See, they exist. It's not just something from ancient stories. Yeah, not just like Bhikkhunis are not like leprechauns or something like that. Learned Buddhism in Thailand, every fortnight we recite the Padimokkha, the list of the rules for the monks. And before the recitation, of course the actual Padimokkha rules themselves, the ancient Pali text, but before we recite that, we'd recite an introduction, a modern Thai introduction, and it says that normally they're one of the duties of the monks is to teach the bhikkhunis if necessary. And it's said that there's no need to do that because the bhikkhunis don't exist anymore. Yeah? So this is what we recited. Bhikkhuni tasang nati tai nati. There's no reason to do that because they don't exist anymore. So they're wrong. They do exist. Yeah? So I'm sure all of you would know a little bit about what a bhikkhuni is and about the issues involved with bhikkhunis and stuff. Does everyone have some familiarity with the background? Yeah? A little bit? So I wanted this evening to be more of an informal discussion about the topic of bhikkhunis and bhikkhuni ordination and so on, because I'm sure many of you may have questions about it. And for myself, I've written two or three books, I can't even remember how many now, about bhikkhunis and how many essays and articles and conferences and seminars and discussions and everything, as well as developing a monastery which supports bhikkhunis to live and practice, where I Upekkha stayed for the last 2 years. So I've done so much work in the field, I can't remember anymore, okay? So I don't want to sort of sit here and go over very basic things that you all know, yeah. And nor do I want to kind of speak above your head and talk about very technical historical things and so on that you might not be interested in. So, you know, if you can let me know as we go along what kinds of things that you're curious about, what kinds of things you maybe had doubts about. Sometimes in this field, in talking about bhikkhunis, because there's a lot of misinformation around and a lot of very confused ideas, which is very unfortunate. So a lot of people have these kind of strange ideas about bhikkhunis and what bhikkhuni ordination means and all of these kinds of things. So we need to try to dispel some of these and try to move the dialogue and move the direction of the tradition in a more helpful and constructive manner. Yeah. So first of all, before we start with the discussion, I'll just give a very brief background. But people often ask me, you know, why do you do so much work to help the bhikkhunis and so on? And I guess there's no simple answer to that, but one answer has to do with the fact that when I was a monk at Bodhinyana, at Ajahn Brahm's monastery, I was visited there by my sister. And my sister's 1 year older than me, and she's a very very good person. She was always the good one of the two of us. I was always the bad boy, and she was always the good one. And we were talking one time, and you know, she said, just very quietly, and she said, you know, she said, I for myself, I don't know if I could ever really commit myself to any particular religion because none of them give women a fair go. And it was really, to me, that was a really, you know, really kind of struck home for me, you know, because I know my sister so well, and I know that she's really such a good person, and she really could benefit from, and would really be a wonderful person to find a spiritual path that really suited her. And I couldn't say anything about it. I couldn't argue. I couldn't say, no, Buddhism does give women a fair go because, well, it doesn't. Certainly Theravada Buddhism. That's a reality. And so I couldn't, you know, what can I say? Yeah. And so I thought that, well, this is very sad, you know, that we live in a world where my sister feels that she can't take up a spiritual path that might be of great benefit for her, maybe great benefit for others, because of these cultural and historical forces. So this is just one little event, but this is one of the reasons why I started to think about this issue and started to look into it. And of course, when you start to look at the question of bhikkhunis, you come up against many, you know, people will give you a lot of reasons and arguments, yeah? They'll say, one argument I heard, one senior monk, he said that a chicken can't lay a duck's egg. Chicken can't lay a duck's egg. What he meant was that in contemporary Buddhism, yeah, in the world today, that the only bhikkhunis around, according to his point of view, were the Mahayana bhikkhunis. Yeah? And so from the Theravadan point of view, you know, Theravadans are ducks and Mahayanas are chickens, and you can't give a chicken can't give birth to a duck. You know, and that's the way that he was thinking about it, yeah? But what was very interesting, this was at a Sangha gathering in Australia, and we had representatives from all the different Buddhist traditions there, yeah? And from the Tibetan and Chinese and Vietnamese and Thai and Sri Lankan, and actually in that tradition, everybody there, all of the monks and nuns, all supported the bhikkhuni ordination, except for one of the Thai monks who was there. Everybody else, the Sri Lankans, Burmese, everybody else supported the bhikkhuni ordination. And what was interesting about it is this monk was saying that, you know, you've got chickens and ducks, i.e. Theravada and Mahayana, I don't know which one's which, but anyway. But he had one Vietnamese monk there talking. And the Vietnamese monk, when he was talking about himself and his Vinaya tradition and his background, he identified himself, not as Mahayana, but he identified himself as Dharmagupta. That was the word that he used. And of course, Dharmagupta is one of the 18 early schools of Buddhism. So have you heard about the 18 early schools of Buddhism? Huh? You don't know about the 18 early schools? Oh, there you go. Well, there's a topic. Come back to that in a minute. And when the Tibetan monk was talking, he identified himself as Mula Sarvastivada, which is his Vinaya tradition. And again, this is one of the 18 early schools of Buddhism. So they identified themselves in terms of their Vinaya lineage, okay, their monastic lineage, as coming from these early schools of Buddhism, whereas that one particular Theravadan monk was saying, oh, you know, they're Mahayanists. They can see these different points of view from their own internal perception. They didn't see themselves as monks, as Mahayanists. Okay? So there's this important difference here. That when we talk about Mahayana, Mahayana actually is not a monastic tradition as such, and it never has been. Mahayana is some texts, philosophies, meditations, devotional practices, all of these kinds of things is what we call Mahayana. But the Mahayana Buddhist tradition has always been founded on the monastic lineages from early Buddhism. It was like that in India and it were in ancient times, and when it went to China and Tibet and so on, that's how it was always. So that they would keep the same monastic traditions, but they would just, you know, they would study some different sutras or do different kinds of chanting or some different kinds of practices and so on. When Buddhism went to these different countries, to China and Tibet and Vietnam and so on, of course Buddhism always adapts to the local culture. Yeah? And the reality, of course, is that when you go from India to, say, Sri Lanka, right, it doesn't have to adapt all that much because Sri Lankan culture is very similar to Indian culture. When they went from India to Tibet, or India to China or Japan, of course they had to adapt much more. The culture is completely different, the climate's completely different, the language is completely different. So that there's a degree of adaptation which the Sangha came to which actually took a long time to develop. And so these days we're used to seeing, say, the Chinese Mahayana bhikkhus and bhikkhunis with a distinctive kind of robes and various kinds of practices, and some aspects of the lifestyle are a little bit different. So, for example, they might eat in the afternoon, whereas in the Theravada they usually don't. But these things all have a history about them. So often from a Theravadan point of view, you think, oh, well, Theravadan monks tend to think, oh, they're not really keeping vinaya because they eat in the afternoon. Yeah, but actually they don't understand the whole history behind it. Actually, what happened when the monks first went to China, they kept that rule about not eating in the afternoon, just like all the other monks did. But, of course, it was freezing cold in the wintertime. It was freezing. So what they did was that they would get smooth pebbles from the river and warm them up and eat them in the afternoon. Yeah? So they would keep themselves warm by taking these hot rocks in the afternoon. Yeah, so that's how they tried to keep the vinaya. That's how diligent they were. Yeah, because otherwise they'd freeze to death. Then after a while they thought, hang on, this is ridiculous. Let's have a bit of rice in the afternoon. So that's how they developed that custom. And it's similar in Tibet. And of course, you know, that's how it is in the beginning, but of course after many, many hundreds of years it becomes part of the culture and they don't think twice about it. But even now, today, many, many monastics in Taiwan, in Korea, in Tibet and so on, you know, they see that now conditions are changing again, and so they're looking at the way they keep these rules and they're adapting them again. For example, a couple of years ago, I was at a conference in Hamburg where with the Dalai Lama, and we actually had lunch together with the Dalai Lama. And you know, I was there, and he said, you know, you have to make sure to serve the lunch before midday because all the monks and nuns have to finish eating before midday. Yeah, that's what he said. It's not, I didn't say that as a Theravadan to him. That's what he said. Yeah. So you know, he's obviously, you know, he's come from this Tibetan tradition where they've got used to eating in the afternoon, but they realize that actually their vinaya texts say that they should only eat in the morning, and as long as they don't have any, you know, critical health problems or other reasons, then that's what they should do. So this is just a bit of background. So this is how, from a historical point of view, while culturally the different kinds of Buddhism on the surface look as if they're quite distinct, but I think if you look underneath, historically, at the backgrounds and at the different rules and the monastic discipline, then actually they're very similar. And only, you know, only some of the, you know, the practices and meditations and teachings and things, you know, they emphasize slightly different aspects. But the underlying code of discipline is all the same. So, it's actually, to me, you know, when I look at these things, I get very excited. Yeah, I think, wow, that's amazing, and then I go and write a book about it or something like that, right? Because I think, isn't that astonishing? You know, I think it's just amazing how all of these different traditions, for thousands of years, across all, completely separated, you know, and these countries for most of the time were completely separate from each other. And yet they still had that sincerity and that dedication of practice to keep the vinaya, keep those texts, and to keep on practicing. Yeah? I think it's just amazing. So when it comes down to the modern times, thank you very much. And we've wanted to try to find, you know, we have this task which every generation of Buddhists faces, and that task is, how do we understand and apply the Dhamma and Vinaya as best as we possibly could here and now, right? And that question has been faced and has been answered in thousands of different ways by Buddhists in all different lands for the last 2,500 years. We all had the same question. How do we understand and apply the teachings of the Buddha as best as we possibly can here and now in these conditions, in this place? Yeah? Every generation of Buddhists in every country faces the same question. And every generation comes up with a slightly different answer. Yeah? That's what a Buddhist tradition is. A Buddhist tradition is a living, evolving heritage of the responses of different people to try to find a way of living the Dhamma as best they can in that time and that place. That's what a tradition is. And it's very important to understand this, because often what I've found when I'm talking about bhikkhunis is that people say, oh, you can't have bhikkhunis because it's the tradition. Well, no, it's not the tradition. The tradition is not something which is fixed and static and stays the same always. The tradition is something which has been living, which has been evolving, which has been changing down through the ages. Yeah? And that the tradition which we've inherited has been a tradition which has adapted to a particular set of circumstances. It worked in that time and that place. But those circumstances have changed. The world that we're living in has changed. Yeah? Even some of these details that I was talking about now, for example, that the detail that the monastic traditions of the different schools is basically the same, that wasn't known a generation ago, yeah, or two generations ago. Yeah, nobody knew that. The research hadn't been done. People hadn't read the texts. They hadn't done the work to be able to find that out. And it's taken a few generations for people to do this. Again, it came up when we were talking with the Dalai Lama, and he said that, I think it was in the 60s or something like that, that he actually asked one of his monks to go to Bangkok and to live and study in Bangkok with the Thai monks and to study their Vinaya and discipline and so on, and to see whether it was compatible with the Tibetan one. And so they did that. And he came back and said, yes, it's basically the same. Yeah? So that research was done. Before that, they didn't know. And so each generation, yeah, we have to answer this question. And the knowledge we have changes, the situation we have changes. So I'm not really impressed when people say, you know, this is the tradition. The other thing that people often don't realize is that the tradition, certainly the Theravadan tradition, is a much more flexible thing than we often realize. We sort of, you know, we get Theravadan tradition, you know, you go down to the Thai temple or something like that, and you think it's always been like that. That's what Thai Buddhism is. But Thai Buddhism isn't like that. Thai Buddhism's changed massively in the last 100 years, not to speak of before that. You know, we know, for example, we know that there were bhikkhunis in Sri Lanka for more than well over 1,000 years. Yeah, it was well documented. In Thailand and Burma, you know, people assume that there never were bhikkhunis, but actually, the oldest record of the first mission ever to that region, which was called in the old text, was called Suvarnabhumi. And we don't quite know where Suvarnabhumi is. These days it's an airport in Bangkok, right? So that's easy. But we don't quite know where it was in those days. And the Thais, of course, say it was Thailand, and the Burmese say it was Burma. And the historians are not quite sure, but most people think it was probably lower Burma was Suvarnabhumi. And actually Malaysia, you know, the top part of Malaysia, actually Malaysia was called Suvarnakuta, the Golden Peninsula. And the first account of the missions to that, which was located in the, according to the Pali account, in the time of King Ashoka, and then that included the conversion and ordination of hundreds of bhikkhunis. Yeah? So that's the very first account of Buddhism in the region, and bhikkhunis were an intrinsic part of that. Down through the years, there is various bits of evidence for the survival of bhikkhuni sangha in Burma and Thailand. There's no connected or detailed history, but there's a reference on an inscription here, or a remark in a traveler's diary there, or a painting on a mural in a temple wall, or something like that, which seems to depict bhikkhunis. So one of the most interesting ones was about the about 1830 or something like that, so quite recent. There was a royal decree in Burma which actually referred to both bhikkhus and bhikkhunis. Yeah, so that's a serious piece of evidence. Yeah, it's a royal decree from the early 19th century in Burma which referred to bhikkhunis as quite normal. Yeah, it's just as ordinary every day. It was just a regulation on the governance of the Sangha, and it just mentioned both bhikkhus and bhikkhunis it's applied to. So there's good reason to think that bhikkhunis have actually been a part of that tradition, at least in some times and places. And it's not, as far as I'm aware, having looked at the history as much as I can, it's not until 1928 that you find in Thailand a ruling banning giving bhikkhuni ordination. So there's a ruling by the Sangharaja there, which was actually given under very terrible and very sad circumstances, which I won't go into the background of that, but there was that ruling then. But I'm not aware of any ruling before 1928 saying that you can't do bhikkhuni ordination. So, you know, that's the tradition. So people say, oh, you know, Thai tradition is you can't have bhikkhunis. Well, no, it's not that clear. The history doesn't tell such a black and white story. History tells a much more nuanced story. And in Thailand today, of course, there are many bhikkhunis. Bhikkhuni Dhammananda, the most famous one in central Thailand. But many others. I think there's about probably 30 or so bhikkhunis in Thailand these days. And of course, many samaneris and so on as well. And they basically get on with their lives and their practice. They're not accepted within official Thai Buddhism. But then I don't know if they particularly want to be. It means they're not under anyone's control. Yeah. And legally in Thailand, the central Thai authorities cannot, by definition, cannot have any control over bhikkhunis. This is something that most people don't understand, because the Thai Sangha Act, which is the Act of Parliament which governs the Sangha in Thailand, defines the Sangha as the bhikkhus and novices. Yeah, so it makes no mention of bhikkhunis, and so all of the institutions of Thai Buddhism actually have no jurisdiction over bhikkhunis whatsoever. And so this is why when Ajahn Brahm and the community of Bodhinyana in 2009, we performed the bhikkhuni ordination, the Thai Sangha made no response whatsoever. The Mahatherasamakom, the governing council, made no response. And to this day, they haven't said a single word about it. And this is the reason, because they have no jurisdiction. As far as the ruling against doing bhikkhuni ordination goes, that ruling was made in 1928, and it's never been tested ever since. It's never actually been legally applied, and the only test of that came in 2003 with the Thai Senate Select Committee. And they discussed, they appointed a committee in the Thai Senate to discuss bhikkhuni ordination and the ordination for women, and they recommended in favour of introducing bhikkhuni ordination, and they said that the 1928 ruling was unconstitutional, yeah, because it contradicted two principles of the Thai constitution. One was the equality for women, and the other was the freedom to practice religion in accordance with your conscience. So they decided this 1928 ruling contradicted both of those principles, which I think is fairly obvious that that's quite correct. It obviously does contradict those things, and as such it's unconstitutional and does not stand. So of course that was just the ruling of the Senate, okay? So the Senate can't, you know, that's just an advisory thing. The Senate can't tell the Sangha what to do or what not to do. And so the Sangha has pretty much let the matter, the mainstream Sangha in Thailand pretty much kind of lets the matter just drift along without making any particular decisions about it. So after quite a few years of talking about these things, discussing them, trying to bring them up and raise them with various monks and so on, and not really getting very far, and I make no secret of it, I'm very disappointed with the monks, especially with the Western monks in my own tradition, the Wat Pa Phong tradition of Ajahn Chah, because I've tried to raise this issue again and again and simply got nowhere, got no response. And so eventually you just kind of give up. Yeah, what can I do? So this is a couple of years ago we decided to do, or Ajahn Brahm decided to do the ordination on the request of the four nuns in Perth who had been keeping the 10 precepts for many years. And he decided to perform that bhikkhuni ordination, and of course I was very honoured to be able to take part in that. So that was the first Theravadan bhikkhuni ordination in Australia, and the first bhikkhuni ordination in the forest tradition anywhere in the world. Yeah. So of course many bhikkhuni ordinations, Theravadan ones previously, mainly in Sri Lanka. I understand that these days there's about 1,000 bhikkhunis in Sri Lanka, and by all accounts the bhikkhuni community is thriving there and very well supported. They still sort of lack official recognition, I think, in certain quarters, but you know, it begins to look a bit silly after a while when you have 1,000 bhikkhunis there and you're sort of saying, well, they don't exist. But, you know, one of the things that I think we need to come back to is that there's a number of issues which are really important. One is the very simple question of human rights, is that it's a basic human right for all people to practice their religion in accordance with their conscience. Yeah? It's a basic human right. Now, if somebody doesn't like bhikkhunis or whatever, well, that's fine. You don't like them. Good on you. But that's got nothing to do with the fact that if somebody wants to take bhikkhuni ordination, then that's their right, okay? And this is a basic human right. Second point that's important to remember is that this taking bhikkhuni ordination is not done. It's not done to annoy people. Yeah, so a lot of people seem to think that we did this bhikkhuni ordination at them. Right, we did it as a way of hurting them or anything. No, we did it as a way of supporting these women in their spiritual aspiration, because they asked for bhikkhuni ordination, and we said, yes, we're pleased to give you this, because it is the training which the Buddha laid down to support the higher spiritual aspirations for women. Okay, this is what the Buddha laid down. Yeah? And so if women want to request that for their own spiritual practice, then I believe it's our duty to support that. And actually, that's not just my belief. That's actually in the Vinaya. And in the Pali Vinaya, there's several passages where it says, for example, that if the bhikkhunis are holding a bhikkhuni ordination and they request the assistance of the bhikkhus, it actually says that the bhikkhus should go, it's their duty to go to assist, even if they're not asked to assist. Yeah, how much more so if they're actually asked? Yeah, so that's a direct quote from the Pali Vinaya, and it's repeated in several passages. So the bhikkhus actually have a duty, according to Vinaya, to support the bhikkhuni ordination. So this is, you know, so these are some of the reasons, because it's a basic human right, because it's the way that the Buddha laid down to support for women to practice to realize Dhamma. But in addition, the bhikkhuni ordination has a broader social significance. And this, I think, is also very important. One of our good friends who's a bhikkhuni, also called Dhammananda, but her name, she's Vietnamese bhikkhuni, but Vietnamese Dhammananda, but she's also a Theravadan bhikkhuni. She's from Vietnam, and she used to practice there for many years, and she used to work with the women's group there and so on. And she found out something that was a very disturbing fact, because they found that the slave traders would come from Thailand to abduct the young girls from the villages and take them back to Thailand to put into the brothels. So these are girls who are like 12, 13, 14 years old. And she, of course, found this to be very disturbing, and she worked to try to save these girls, put them into refuges and so on. And what she found out was that in different areas of Vietnam, that things worked out differently. If it was in the cities, in the urban regions, where it was mainly the communist government and the kind of mainly a secular environment, then the slave traders didn't go there, because the communist government in Vietnam has done many, many very bad things, but one good thing that they've done is promoted equality for women. So they don't go to those areas. They don't go to the Mahayana areas, yeah, because Mahayana temples all have bhikkhunis in them, and they teach the women and the girls, and they all have self-esteem and confidence. But they go to the Theravadan areas. They specifically target the Theravadan areas of Vietnam, and they take the girls from there. And when she went to the temple to tell the monks about this and inform them and say, you know, this is happening in your village, right? Down there, those people who offer you dana every day, yeah, they're coming, and those girls from that family that you know have been taken and sold into slavery, yeah, in the brothels in Bangkok. Please do something about it. Then the monks, she asked, they said, sorry, we can't say anything because it's their karma. It's their karma. Yeah, this is what they said. And this is not the only time that I've heard this. I've heard this many times, that people say these kinds of things. So having bhikkhunis in the Sangha and having bhikkhunis in the Buddhist culture will have a major, major impact on the society at large, far beyond just the individual impact of having a few nuns in one place or the other. And that impact will happen automatically. Some nuns will choose to work in social fields and actually, you know, actively do that. Others won't be socially active. You know, they may be more meditative or studying, but still that impact will be felt. There'll be a role model. There'll be somebody to look up for, yeah? Who do these girls look up for now, yeah? Who do they get to idolize, yeah? The young girls in the villages, yeah? Who's their role model? Lady Gaga? Yeah? It's serious. I mean, that's who they have as their role model, yeah? But they don't have any spiritual women who they can look to, yeah? The boys do. The boys can say, oh, there's the monks walking and they look, they're very peaceful and they're very serene and, oh, maybe one day I could be a monk and, you know? So they can look up to that. But the girls, they don't. They haven't got that. And so this, you know, I'm very convinced will have a major impact in countries like Thailand, where the domestic violence against women is rife, where the sex industry is, as you know, is one of the worst in the world, where there's a lot of slavery of young girls and so on. All of these very, very terrible things. And I have no doubt that with a strong and healthy Bhikkhuni Sangha, that a lot of these kinds of issues would be greatly helped. Yeah? In fact, I think that's the only way that will actually address these things in a country like Thailand. If you travel around Thailand through the villages and so on, you know, I was there as a monk for many years, and I honestly can't remember how many times, I'm trying to think in my head, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times off the top of my head when people offered me a monastery. Okay? Oh, Bhante, please come and stay in our village. You know, we have a lovely temple there, lots of buildings, but there's no monks. Yeah? Please, Bhante, come. You know, we've got 500 acres of land, you know? Seriously. But we don't have any monks. Yeah? And, you know, this happened many times. And that's how it is when you go around Thailand, yeah? A lot of empty monasteries, yeah? And it's quite natural, you know, that Thailand's been a very fast-developing country and, you know, the young guys all used to go to the monastery to ordain because, well, that was the only way they could get out of working on the rice paddies all day. But these days they have more choices, yeah? So, you know, they go to university, they go and get professions and so on. And it's natural. It happens everywhere, yeah? And we'll see it happening. I think it's already happening in Sri Lanka. But with the ending of the war and Sri Lanka development will accelerate. And we'll see that happening in Sri Lanka a lot more as well. And if Burma ever gets free from this military dictatorship and starts to develop more, we'll see the same thing happening in Burma as well. And so in these countries where there's such a great shortage of monks and a great shortage of practicing monastics, then again, the Bhikkhuni Sangha is a great answer to actually find someone to supply these kind of spiritual needs. Okay, so, look, I've been talking for too long. I said this is going to be a discussion thing, and then I've gone on talking. So anyway, how about some questions? Maybe we get we've got a radio mic here, so. So come on, number one. So you're going to win the prize. You're going to have the most wisdom in your next life. think on the side there's a switch.
Okay, this is for Bikuni Rebecca. Is that how you pronounce your name?
Upeka.
Sorry about that. Why did you decide to become a Bikuni, and did it fuel the void in your life?
Well, to cut a long story short, it was mainly because of the many inequalities that I saw in life. I was actually educated in a convent school. I was a volunteer in churches and all that, but I just thought that there were just too much inequalities in life, and I was actually looking for an answer. And it so happened that one day one of our family members actually brought me a little booklet on Buddhism, and I thought, wow, this is the answer I was looking for, that everyone is, you know, answerable to what, you know, one has done. Yeah. And also because another really strong impact was when I was doing voluntary work as a befriend, I saw lots of people, you know, actually suffering. And there was once when I was asked this question when I was doing a sharing session with other volunteers and other supporters, and they asked this question, you know, do you really think that you are helping those people? And I told them, no, I could only give them comfort for that very particular moment or that day that I was spending with them. But if I really want to help them, I think that teaching them the Dhamma to get out of samsara is the best way to help them. And of course, other factors were things like, you know, seeing my friends losing their children, you know, when they were so young, and all those things actually help contribute towards, you know, telling me that things are really impermanent and there's just too much suffering, and that I'm not even, you know, the owner of my children or anybody. So all those things actually helped me to decide that I really want to tread the path of the Buddha and, you know, help myself as well as to help others to get out of suffering once and for all. And the only way was to become a bhikkhuni. Yeah, but I became a bhikkhuni in the Mahayana tradition first, because at that time I didn't know about Theravada bhikkhunis. Yeah. Yes, I was ordained in Taiwan as a Mahayana nun, and I remained as a Mahayana nun for five years before I thought of learning more about Vinaya and all that, because I found that my direction was not fulfilled as a Mahayana nun. I just didn't want to wear the robe and just live an ordinary life. I started to search for Vinaya and Dhamma and meditation practice, and ended up in Santi.
Maybe just a curious question. How many of the ladies here are thinking of becoming a nun? I know there are some here. I know there are some here, but maybe just a show of hands, don't be shy. Sajin? We had a young woman here that aspired to be a nun. Any of you wanted to be a nun or something like that, or just curious? Kim, you want to ask some questions, right?
Yes. Bhante, I must confess, I'm interested in this issue when it came out, and I was upset that there was all the incidences, because it didn't gel with the compassion that I felt that what we were being taught. But my confession is, I didn't go and follow up and read a lot of the to's and fro's, and
it was a little bit too much to read, wasn't it?
And I just put it to that there could be cultural influences that made senior monks decide in the way that they did. I don't know, so I guess if you do not mind to give some of the pros and cons, if that's okay, about the issue. I've just sort of parked it one side, but I do feel that, you know, hey, there's something out there that doesn't gel with what the teaching says.
Sure. Look, and I agree, and I think it's very hard. And look, it's important to voice that, and it's important to be honest about that in public, because what I've found is that a lot of people have the same question, yeah, and a lot of people think, hey, you know, I came to Buddhism to learn how to love people more and how to be more open and how to be more compassionate. How come suddenly we're finding all of these very kind of narrow and rigid ways of thinking? Yeah. And I think it's a very valid question, and I'll be honest, it's one that I've struggled with for many years and which I continue to struggle with. Yeah. You know, we've still had more incidents in recent weeks. These things, it's not over yet. People still saying these things. We've had one monk who's formerly at Ajahn Brahm's monastery is now written saying, you know, he used to get Ajahn Brahm's talks emailed to him. So now he can't get the talks emailed to him because he's staying in a branch monastery of Wat Pa Phong, and they can't have any contact with Ajahn Brahm. Yeah? Yeah? And monks have been told, you can't go and stay at this monastery because you're one of Ajahn Brahm's monks, so, you know, you can't stay here. Or, you know, another monk said that he had an article to be published in the BSWA newsletter in Perth, and he said, no, you can't publish my article because, you know, I can't have any contact with Ajahn Brahm, and all of these things, yeah? And many, many more like that. That's just a few, yeah? Many things. And so you think, my goodness, what's going on? How can people be so petty? So, what really is happening? I've had to struggle with this because it's my community. It's a sangha that I ordained in. I lived beside these monks. I practiced with them. They taught me. I've got incredible gratitude to them because they brought me into the holy life. You know, showed me how to put my robes on and how to carry a bowl and how to do the Pali chanting and everything. Yeah, and yet I just can't accept some of these attitudes and some of these things that's been going on. So I've really had to struggle a lot. And I don't think there's any simple answer. There's many different answers. But if I was to look at it, one of the dynamics which has been very apparent and which most people are surprised by is that it's very often it's the Western monks, the Western Ajahns, who have been the most opposed to bhikkhuni ordination. So some people have tried to make this into a kind of a racial issue. They say, oh, this is these Westerners trying to bring these feminist ideas into Asian Buddhism, blah, blah, blah. Yeah? And so we get these kinds of criticism. And we try to say, well, actually, the Buddha was an Asian. We're actually Westerners who've gone to Asia to learn Asian ways and trying to bring those good Asian traditions back into the West, not the other way around, yeah? And but sometimes it's difficult to get these ideas across. But what we found is a lot of the Western monks have been opposing bhikkhuni ordination, yeah? And often quite strongly. And so this, you know, raises all these kind of questions about what's going on. And I don't want to be, you know, simplistic or you know, I don't want to be critical or anything like that. I just want to try to understand things. One of the things which is going on, which, you know, I know from my experience at Wat Manachat and from other monasteries around, is this. When, as Westerners, we come to, say, to Thailand, to the forest tradition, or to Buddhism generally, yeah, we often have this there's this kind of golden glow about everything, right? It's this kind of, sometimes they call it Orientalism, right? It's this kind of idea that kind of Westerners have, is that they can kind of project this idea that the East is the home of these wonderful, pure spiritual traditions, and everybody who lives in the Orient is kind of floating above the earth and doing profound meditations and all of these things. I mean, that's an exaggeration, but you know the idea. Yeah, this is a kind of stereotype which Westerners have had for a long time about the so-called mystic Orient. And this, there's a kind of hangover of this kind of attitude for a lot of us when, you know, most of us as young men, like myself, who are disillusioned and disappointed with what life in the West has to offer. We can't believe in and accept the spiritual answers which our traditions give to us, right? We've rejected Christianity. You know, there's kind of New Age religions and stuff which are all pretty shallow. You know, they have some nice things about them, but they're pretty shallow. And then you've got this very kind of secular materialist world, and, you know, that's not very satisfying either. So we're looking for something. And we have this intuition that somehow, you know, in the Asian spiritual traditions, there's something really deep and pure. And, you know, it's interesting if you look at the history. So, for example, in the 60s, you know, most of the Westerners who felt like that went to India and practiced Hinduism. Yeah, but very soon that actually shifted. And I think one of the main reasons was because of the caste system. Yeah, because, you know, it soon became obvious that Hinduism was really bound up with this caste system. And, of course, it was something that people from the West couldn't accept. And so then from the 70s onwards, the focus shifted very much to Buddhism, where it remains today. And so this is why there's this strong interest in Buddhism. And so we come, and, you know, when we arrive at the monasteries, like, everything is just so wonderful, yeah? And we get there, it's like, wow, it's amazing, you know? These people are so, so virtuous, yeah? They're so content. Yeah, we've come from this world, everyone's seeking after these material things, and finally, it's like an Eden, it's like a paradise, yeah, where everyone is just so careful and mindful and just content with just very little, and we can do these meditations, and we really experience it, we really feel, we really know that these things work, yeah, and this is my experience, yeah, it's a very powerful thing. And so because you're so transfixed by this glow, by this radiance of all the things genuinely which are so good about the tradition, you tend to not notice the shadow side, the dark side, yeah? And everything has its shadow, yeah? Everything has its shadow, and Buddhism has its shadow. And fortunately, the shadows of Buddhism, I don't think, are quite as dark as the shadows of some other religions, but you shall remain nameless, but it still has a shadow side, and particularly the treatment of women is one of those things, yeah? And so as a man going to that monastery, you know, I mean, I'm having to let go of so many things, my conditioning, my culture, my language, all of these things I'm having to let go of, and I'm having to subject myself to a radically different environment in so many ways, yeah? And so there's this very fast and very radical shifting of personality and having to adapt to so many things. And so while you're in this process of adapting, you know, the fact that women are completely marginalized and sidelined, it's just one more thing to adapt to, yeah, after among so many other things, yeah. So this is one thing. The other thing, of course, is that for young monks, when they come along, is dealing with sexual desire, of course, is a big part of becoming a monk, yeah, and being able to let go of that. So it's actually, you know, you can see it's actually helpful to be in a monastery where you're very secluded for a period of time. So individually, for the monks themselves, it's not an actual problem, yeah. But of course, what's lacking is any kind of compassion, yeah. And this is something which, you know, it's almost a cliche to say that Theravada, well, it's not a cliche, it is almost a cliche, it is a cliche to say Theravadins are, you know, only concerned with their own salvation, yeah? And they're lacking compassion. But, you know, I have to say that this is the case much more than it should be. And within the monks' communities, everything's very inward looking, yeah? And if you listen to the conversations which go on among the monks, it's all talking about this monk or that monk and so on and so forth. It's always concerned within its own little sphere, yeah? And so, you know, again, psychologically, you can understand why, because the monks want to, you know, they need to build up this sense of who they are. You know, we've completely left behind our old self, who we were in the past. It's been completely left behind, and we need to build up this sense of self-esteem, this sense of self-worth, this sense of knowing who we are, finding connection and relationship within this community of monks. And so, you know, it's very noticeable that all of the language, the discussions, the concern is always concerned about that. And the question of bhikkhunis or women's practice and all of these things just doesn't arise. Yeah? It just doesn't come up at all. You know, the only women around are lay women. They come and they offer dana, and you know, you appreciate the fact they offer dana and so on. But they're not taken seriously, really, as practitioners. Yeah, and as dhamma, you know, dhamma equals in any way. Yeah? That's just how it is in that community. That's how I found it. So, one of the things which then happens is because for the young monks when they come along, is that they become very, very powerfully attached to their Thai teachers and the Thai ajans, yeah? And there's a very, very strong, you know, one of the main things in the community is always like, you know, who's an arahant and who's a non-returner and who's a stream enterer and who's got this jhana or who's got that jhana and so on. Of course, nobody really knows, you know, but it doesn't stop you from gossiping about it, right? And so people have a lot of faith in their teachers, yeah? And of course, that's, you know, that's a good thing, yeah? It's a very inspiring, and many of the teachers are very inspiring, and many of them probably do have these stages of enlightenment and so on, yeah? So I'm not being skeptical about this at all. It's a wonderful thing, and it's, you know, people see, again, because we've lost so much from coming from the Western background. So I'm talking here about Western psychology. So for yourselves, maybe a little bit different from the cultural background. But from the West, we've lost so much. And we don't have any conception of like our own really authentic spiritual tradition. It just doesn't exist in the West anymore. The last really authentic Western spiritual tradition was probably in Russia in the mid-19th century, and they had an ascetic contemplative tradition there. But since then, there's been nothing. So, you know, we find, oh, actually, it is possible to have these really pure, realized beings, yeah, who actually exist on the earth, and we can be with, and we can learn from. So this is a very, very powerful kind of thing. But underneath it all, there's also a lot of projection going on. A lot of idealization. This golden glow is covering everything. So that, you know, it's not enough that somebody be a wise teacher, but that everything that comes out of their mouth has to be some kind of great pearl of wisdom. Yeah? And I've heard this said even by the Thai Ajahns themselves. I'll just give you one example. And we had one monk visiting Bodhnyana, and he was a monk who has a good reputation for meditation, and people say that he can, you know, he's got very psychic powers and he can read people's minds and so on. And, you know, he was there, and one of the monks, a German monk, wanted to go and ask him questions. And this German monk is a very kind of funny fellow, but is highly intelligent, very, very intellectual, kind of classic German intellectuals, kind of thick glasses, and always kind of used to have his head buried in books all day long and so on. And he used to literally write lists of hundreds of Dhamma questions and post them around the world to Bhante Gunaratana or Bhante Tanisaro or someone and ask these questions of all these monks. And so he comes up to this Thai monk, you know, with his kind of notebook and his kind of thick glasses and his lists of questions, and finally, you know, thinking he can, you know, wondering whether he can ask questions. And so this Thai monk was talking through an interpreter, and he sort of remarked, "Oh, I can see, you know, you're someone who, you know, you're a very intelligent person." Yeah, and that's actually the Thai word that they use is panya, yeah, which means wisdom. But actually in Thai, panya just means intelligent. Yeah, it doesn't necessarily mean you have spiritual wisdom or anything. Oh, so I can see that you're, you know, you're obviously an intelligent guy. Yeah. And he translated that, and then when this monk said, he said, "Oh, really? What? Did you see something?" And immediately assumed, yeah, that he's seen something special. Wow, it must be. And the Thai monk says, no, I was just making a comment, you know. And I've heard actually the Thai monk say this actually quite a few times, yeah, that sometimes, you know, they're just passing a casual remark, and people take what they're saying very seriously. So there's this kind of relationship where the Western monks get used to this relationship of being in awe and this aura around what the Thai monks are, who they are, what they say and what they do. And in that kind of relationship, it becomes impossible to question them. And this is, I think, this is one of the key points. It becomes impossible to seriously question it. And and these kind of difficulties don't get translated from the Western monks to the Thai monks. They get internalized and kept within the Western community. and the Thai monks don't know about it. Yeah, and so if you asked about a lot of these issues around bhikkhunis and so on, the Thai monks, you know, and especially in the Ajahn Chah tradition and so on, wouldn't know anything about it. You know, most of the Ajahns would never have seen a bhikkhuni in their life. They would never have read the bhikkhuni Vinaya. They would never have, you know, any notion about bhikkhunis or whatever, except for what they've heard from other monks. And the whole international dialogue, the revival of bhikkhunis in Sri Lanka, the research that's been done by modern scholars, all of these kinds of things is known to some degree within the Western monks, but they internalize it, and it doesn't get translated, and it doesn't get put through. So this is why, like, Ajahn Brahm made some attempt to do this. You know, he had the Bhikkhu Bodhi did his book on bhikkhuni ordination a few years ago, and Ajahn Brahm organized for that to be translated into Thai and published and distributed and so on. So, you know, he made attempts, but, you know, it's only one little thing. Yeah, you can't change a culture like that. So anyway, this is kind of one of the reasons, I think, which is underlying some of the problems which we've had. So this is why I think that some of the misunderstandings have come from, you know, like for Ajahn Brahm and myself, you know, we want to be in a relationship with other monks where we can discuss things. And to me, that's a mature relationship. It's like a relationship of brothers, that we can sit and we can talk and we can disagree with each other. And that's how a dialogue happens. Whereas for most of the monks, it seems you can only be most of the monks in the Ajahn Chah tradition, specifically, you can only be in a subservient relationship. So you can only accept what the someone above you says, and you can't question it ever. So another question. Yep.
Okay. I was just going to say that in the past I wanted to be a nun, like, immediately kind of thing, but now I'm just like letting it go with the flow and things like that, so I'm still okay. Yeah, so I was going to ask a question about the monastic tradition, because take for example, like, maybe for meals, the nuns have to walk behind the monks to get their meals. Am I correct? Or?
Well, that depends on, there's no rule in the Vinaya about mm-hmm. that, so that depends on the policy in a particular monastery.
Okay.
So at Santi Monastery, we have the policy that we just take our meals according to seniority, regardless of whether you're a monk or a nun.
Okay. Yeah. So for example, the monasteries that have this kind of tradition that the nun has to walk behind the monk, so what do you think that, like, because some of the nuns that enter into the monastics, they might be struggling with it, like, oh, why do we have to walk behind the monks and things like that? But then it's also an opportunity for them to, like, learn about, you know, about non-self and things like that. So do you think it's okay, like, okay, for they can have it that way, such that the nuns can also overcome it and learn from it? And or you think, like, it's okay, we can also change the tradition such that according to seniority, so that it will kind of show the lay people more that, like, you know, women can look up to the nuns and things like that.
Look, I think that, you know, again, to come back to this idea of tradition as it's really lived, the reality is that every tradition is different. And there is no one tradition. And, you know, I lived in Thailand for 6 years and I've visited many monasteries, and at no two monasteries did they ever do everything exactly the same. That's the reality. So the way that the world will go is that in different places they'll have different policies. Personally, I think it's best to be as equal and as fair as possible. But I also think that it's best to focus on the things that are most important. Right? If people are going to be really hung up about who goes first in the line at the food and stuff like that, it's like, oh, come on, guys, you know, you'll all get something to eat at the end of the day. You know, we had some nuns visiting us from Taiwan, Nan Lin Temple in Taiwan, and they're very well-practiced bhikkhunis, and we went for alms round, went for Pindabhata, yeah? And the bhikkhuni said, you know, with respect, can we ask if the bhikkhus go in front, yeah, because we want to film the Pindabhata and we want to show to the people back in Taiwan. And they'll be a bit shocked if they see the... Because the nun who was there, the abbess, was actually very senior. She's much senior to me. So I wanted to put her in the front. So they said, oh, well, in Taiwan, they'll be shocked to see me walking in front of a bhikkhu. And so, you know, with respect, they asked if they could do it like that. And so I considered it and I said, well, you know, I respect that tradition, yeah, but you're in Australia now, yeah? So can I ask that you respect, and in Australia, people will be shocked if they see, you know, the women having to walk behind all the time, yeah? So can I ask that we walk in terms of seniority, but when we finished, we can rearrange ourselves, put the monks in front, and then you can film that and show it back in Taiwan. So that's what we did, yeah? So, you know, these things, they shouldn't be a problem. It's just etiquette. Yeah? It's, you know, when you're laying out the dinner table and you're told, should you put the knives to the right of the forks or to the left? You know, these kinds of things. It shouldn't be something for people to get, you know, very, you know, upset about. You know, and we should try to just deal that with dignity and respect.
Hello, that's Ajahn. What are the other kind of counter arguments to bhikkhuni ordination you faced, and what was your response to it? Because was there, like, for example, was there a strong mindset of this, was using this argument where I've heard that it was Buddha actually commented that if he were to allow bhikkhunis into the Sangha, the Dharma would go into decline a lot sooner, and I've heard it's been debunked, but do you come across this counter argument a lot? And what other arguments do you come across?
With the ordination that we did in Perth in 2009, we kind of expected, we're actually a bit surprised, we expected more in terms of sort of vinaya or scriptural based arguments against what we had done. And we took quite a bit of care to do things as best as possible to avoid that possibility. Practically speaking, in my experience, I've found that those kinds of arguments, they kind of more hang around in the background. Yeah? That people don't tend to make them explicit so much. They don't, in my experience, but they kind of contribute unconsciously to the climate around bhikkhuni ordination. Yeah? But they're not used explicitly as arguments. The actual explicit arguments that were used for at the time we did the ordinations in Perth were primarily arguments based on the legality of doing bhikkhuni ordination under Thai law. Yeah, if you look at the actual decisions made by Wat Pa Phong is the head monastery that Ajahn Chah established. So they have meetings every year now about. Oh, 2005, I think, or 2006 was the first time that bhikkhuni ordination was addressed. It was very briefly mentioned, and it just said that bhikkhuni ordination should not be performed in accordance with the ruling of the Mahathera Samakom, the Council of Elders in Thailand. Yeah? Now, of course, the problem is that the Council of Elders has not really made a ruling on bhikkhuni ordination, and this decision that was made at Wat Pa Phong is based on an interpretation which is not really valid. And then later on, in another decision made at Wat Pa Phong, they said we don't support bhikkhuni ordination. Right? So again, that doesn't mean you can't do it, but it just means they don't like the fact that you're doing it. So these rulings made at Wat Pa Phong actually were a bit ambiguous. Clearly it was that they didn't support bhikkhuni ordination, that was clear, but there was certainly no hint in any of those, and in no case did it ever, in the 1928 ruling in Thailand, nor in any of the rulings of Wat Pa Phong, did it ever suggest any punishment for doing bhikkhuni ordinations. It merely said we don't support it, yeah? Never said if you support it, we're going to kick you out, or we're going to do all of these things. Yeah, never said anything like that. It just said we don't support it. So when this came up, you know, we had no idea that people would react so violently to what we did, and we were quite shocked at the response. Mostly the thing that was brought up was that it was against the decision of Wat Bapong. And so this was the main thing that Ajahn Brahm was criticized for, was for going against the decision of Wat Bapong. And even though he asked them to please explain in more detail, you know, whether they had any objections according to Vinaya, then they wouldn't do that. They didn't answer his questions. There was an article written by Venerable Tanisaro, who's a well-known American monk, and apparently some of the Ajahn Chah tradition monks went to him and asked him to write a refutation of the ordination, and he did so, and he raised some Vinaya objections to the ordination, but the Vinaya objections he raised were so tenuous and so weak that he was immediately criticized by at least half a dozen scholars all around the world, including Bhikkhu Bodhi and Ajahn Brahm and myself and Venerable Brahmali and even Tenzin Palmo and many other venerables all kind of weighed in. And so I don't really think that those particular objections got any traction anywhere. It certainly wasn't the foundation of what the objections were. The main thing was that Ajahn Brahm had gone against the wishes of the Ajahns at Wat Bapong. That was the main thing he was being criticized for. Well, there's a lot of things behind it, yeah? There's a lot of things which kind of fueled it. And one of the things that you can see, I think the fact that there was so much energy came out, you know, that's one undeniable fact right at that time. There's a lot of energy, yeah? People felt, I could feel it, you know, it felt really kind of energized and, you know, came out and all the communications and movement and everything. And so I think actually underneath, there are probably a lot of things which had been stuck there for many years and which no one had been able to say, yeah? And so popped out and everyone said them, not necessarily very skillfully, but at least they got said, yeah? So I think that in a sense that's not a bad sign, yeah, in the long term. At least things are a bit clearer, yeah? And I think one thing that is important is that I mentioned this a bit earlier, that you know, so many people have felt confused and alone, yeah? Because they've seen these things happening and they've just been, I can't understand, why is it like this? And, you know, I've been hearing these voices for years, yeah? Especially women's voices, also men's voices, but especially women's voices. And since people got to know that I've been interested in these issues, I've been having emails and phone calls and letters and so on from so many women for years now, 5, 6, 7 years, telling me about their experiences, telling me about how they, you know, they came to monasteries with such inspiration and aspiration, and then after a while they just felt so disillusioned and so disappointed and had to leave the monastery and so on. And, you know, if you hear these letters once or twice, you know, you maybe think somebody's just complaining or whinging or something, but when you hear it so many times, and when you get to know some of the people and you realize actually they're not, you know, they're not complainers, they're not whingers, they've got a genuine point to make. So I think it's good actually that things are now out in the open. At least we've got an idea of where we stand.
Ajahn, just want to get my history right. The forest tradition is set up by Ajahn Chah, and it is part of the Theravada Buddhism, right? So this Bhikkhuni ordination is actually being opposed by the forest tradition monks, or the forest tradition Ajahns, rather than Theravada on its own whole. Is that right?
That's almost right, yeah. The only thing is that the forest tradition is actually much broader than the Ajahn Chah tradition as such. Okay, so the forest tradition is actually an ancient tradition of Buddhism from the Buddha's time, and each country has its own forest tradition. Yeah, Sri Lanka has its forest tradition, Burma has its forest tradition, even like Vietnam and so on have their forest tradition. And in Thailand, the modern forest tradition mainly stems from Ajahn Mun. And, you know, he was the great reformer and founder. There was a forest tradition before Ajahn Mun, but the modern forest tradition mainly stems from him. And his followers mainly are in what they call the Dhammayutta Nikaya, okay? So the Dhammayutta sect of Buddhism in Thailand, okay? Now, there's probably maybe 10,000, yeah, forest monks in the Dhammayutta tradition in Thailand. And Ajahn Chah is not part of the Dhammayutta tradition. He's part of the other group of monks in Thailand called Mahanikaya. And so, you know, there's, I don't know, 1,500, maybe 2,000 monks who are Ajahn Chah tradition monks also in the forest tradition. So the forest tradition is that whole, and the Ajahn Chah tradition is one part of that whole in Thailand. Yeah.
So the bhikkhuni ordination is basically opposed by the forest tradition. It's not Theravada on its own.
By the Ajahn Chah tradition. By the Ajahn Chah tradition. You know, the rest of the forest tradition hasn't made any pronouncement on it, as far as I'm aware.
Thank you.
So it's only a small circle. And even, you know, you say it's the Ajahn Chah tradition, well, it's actually only a few monks who are making the decisions. Yeah. Most of the time, you know, if you hang around in the monks' communities, honestly, most of the time, most of the monks are like, oh, yeah, okay. And it's actually only a few who, you know, who call the shots, yeah? Everyone else sort of goes along with it. Yeah. So it's a bit in this case, it's a bit unfortunate. Yeah.
Okay. After 12 years, right? Is it right?
That's right, yeah.
I have a feeling, I think there may be some people who are having the fear, you know, the bhikkhunis will be multiplying because these four bhikkhunis can ordain somebody after 12 years, right?
Yeah. That's right, they'll be taking over soon.
Yeah. Now, in Thailand, you still don't get full bhikkhuni, right?
They do, yeah. They have about 30 bhikkhunis now in Thailand.
That means with full ordination?
That's right, yeah.
Then who are the bhikkhus who ordained them?
Most of the time they went to Sri Lanka to take ordination.
I think
one or two occasions they've actually had bhikkhuni ordination in Thailand. I'm not sure about that, but certainly most of them went to Sri Lanka. Yeah.
Otherwise, if they don't have the full bhikkhuni ordination, they have to remain as 10 preceptors, right?
That's right, yeah. But you know, the point you make is a very good one, is that the bhikkhunis then, you know, ordain their own students. And so this is, you know, in a sense, this is where the women's community, as intended by the Buddha, is autonomous. Yeah, the bhikkhunis ordain other bhikkhunis. They run their own communities. And the vinaya is constructed. The vinaya is always called the Ubhato Vinaya, the twofold vinaya. So Theravada likes to think of itself as a Vinaya tradition, but actually they're only practicing half the Vinaya. Yeah, they're only practicing the monk's Vinaya. There's a twofold Vinaya. Now the Vinaya essentially sets up the bhikkhuni ordination with a very, very high degree of autonomy, and it's actually quite radical and quite extraordinary. The bhikkhunis would ordain other bhikkhunis, they would teach, they would be mentors, they would do all kinds of things, and you find stories in the Vinaya where the bhikkhunis are like managing building projects and all of these kinds of things. Yeah, and so they obviously had quite a high degree of autonomy, even in that time in ancient India, where obviously, as even today in India, women have very little autonomy. So there are a few points in the Vinaya where the bhikkhu and bhikkhuni community come together for certain key junctures like performing ordinations and various things like that. And so they provide points of contact between the bhikkhu and bhikkhuni sangha. But for the most part, the bhikkhunis are able to operate with a large degree of autonomy. So this, I think you're quite right, is one of the fears, is that if the bhikkhunis can ordain themselves and run their own communities, that they'll be out of the control of the monks, yeah? And who knows what you're going to have with all these out-of-control bhikkhunis rampaging around the place. Oh, who knows what they might be doing, you know, meditating and helping people and teaching Dhamma. Could just get completely out of control. But, you know, one of the things that I know, and I've heard this, you know, directly, is that, the Thai monks look to, say, what's happening in Taiwan, and they say, you know, if you have bhikkhunis around, look what's happening in Taiwan. There's four times as many nuns as there are monks. Yeah? Imagine what could happen here in Thailand if we had four times as many nuns as monks. Yeah? So this definitely is one of the fears they have.
Now I'm in Singapore. I was born in Sri Lanka. Now the families have become smaller, two in a family. So if there's two sons or son and a daughter, the parents are not willing to. They are not happy. You know, their son becoming a monk, because who's going to look after the family and things like that. So in time to come, if there's no bhikkhuni ordinate, then the number of monks both will go down and down. Even in Sri Lanka, some of the temples don't find enough monks now.
Oh, look, absolutely, and again, that's a very, very valid point. You know, in modern times with contraception, family planning, and also with quite seriously, and also with affluence. Yeah, and as we know, as societies become more affluent, the families have less children. And in the past, I mean, it sounds funny, but it's true. You know, if you had nine kids, oh well, you know, send one or two off to the monastery, you'll hardly miss them. Yeah? But if you've only got one or two, then it really becomes a big deal. Yeah, so look, I agree completely. That's a very important point. Yeah. You have to be like my mum. See, my mum's more Buddhist than most Buddhists are, you know, and I hear all these people in Singapore and they say, oh yeah, I wanted to become a monk, but, you know, my mum wouldn't let me and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, when I wanted to become a monk, my mum was living in Laos and she was teaching English there. And I went to see her, to ask her permission to ordain. And so I went to see her and I said, do I have your permission to seek ordination? And she said, she gave her permission, and she said that her Lao friends were so happy for her, and they told her that, you know, now you're definitely going to go to heaven. And they told her that, and she said, you know, my now because she's got two children, and my daughter can look after her in this life, and I'll look after her in the next one. So she had very, very good understanding of it, much better than most of the Buddhists, yeah.
I think nowadays, a lot of people go and see a monk for counseling. I have a feeling, you know, if there are bhikkhunis, the ladies are more free to discuss their problems.
That's true, yeah. And definitely, you know, and again, this is another concern which I've heard raised among the bhikkhus. Some bhikkhus, they say that, you know, most of our supporters come from women. So if bhikkhunis get ordained, firstly, half of our supporters will become bhikkhunis, so they won't be able to give us dana anymore. And the other half won't need us for their teaching and counselling and support, because obviously the bhikkhunis will do a much better job than we will. So, you know, how are we going to eat? Yeah. So, yeah, actually, we had a question here earlier, so we'll come there in a minute. Yep.
So, Ajahn, this morning you mentioned that Australian Buddhists are more quiet, that they don't complain so much. Mm. But I think is it different in Singapore that we used to complain a lot? And especially during 2009 when Ajahn Brahm did the bhikkhuni ordination, I think there are a lot of comments comes about in Singapore within Singaporeans. So is it advisable, like, for Singaporeans to really learn not to complain so much?
I don't know if I think the comment was Australian Buddhists don't complain much compared to other Australians. Yeah, so maybe that was the comment, rather than that they, I don't know whether Australian Buddhists complain more or less than Singaporean Buddhists. That would be a matter for a sociological study. We'd have to do a survey of that, yeah? Yeah. But look, you know, in those kinds of things, I mean, yes, you know, some people will complain and there'll be a lot of negativity and criticism, but it's important, you know, those things, you know, shouldn't be taken too seriously, but they need to be allowed. It needs to be okay to voice legitimate complaints, because it was a matter of legitimate and very serious concern for all of us. So it's important that we don't just dismiss the, some of it may be just complaining and whinging and not so important, but it's important that people feel that they can voice if they have important concerns. Yeah. So another question we had?
In Thailand, do you think there is already more than enough of temple and meditation center? And second, why there are so many senior monks or so would like to build temple or monastery of their own if they have already got so many temples in Thailand?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I'm not quite sure. I think there's probably too many temples in Thailand. I don't know about meditation centres though. Yeah, probably not. Probably could do with a few more meditation centres. But the temples, yeah, there's certainly a lot of them. And look, I would agree. I think that often it becomes just something to do, or something, you know that's the done thing, is you build a big temple and make a nice hall and all of these kinds of things. And I would like to see, you know, this is one of the things, and I think, you know, this is something also we forget, is that when we talk about the forest tradition, Ajahn Mun and Ajahn Chah, is that they were radicals, they were reformists, they weren't traditionalists. They didn't. Ajahn Chah and Ajahn Mun didn't come along and say, "Here we are in Thailand. We have to do everything just as everybody else in Thailand does." Quite on the contrary, they came out and they actually threw out large parts of conventional Thai Buddhism, including that part about like building lots of big monasteries and fancy buildings and all of these kinds of things. And if you go to traditional forest monasteries, you'll find everything very, very simple. Yeah, just simple wooden buildings, simple sala. And, you know, you don't necessarily see that these days, because a lot of the forest monasteries are actually much more developed even than the city monasteries. But if you look at the real hardcore forest monasteries, like, say, Ajahn Mahabur's monastery, you know, and he just kept it exactly as it was and refused any attempts to build things. You know, he was such a great example of a forest monk, you know. And I don't know if any of you visited Lung Da Bua's monastery. You know, he passed away just a short time ago. But it's just astonishing, you know. He was just, everything was still dirt paths, simple, you know, wooden kutis, a wooden sala, not very big, everyone having to crowd in and fit in, and no electricity, you know, so simple he kept everything. And, you know, he was the most famous monk in Thailand, you know, and got so many donations, yeah? Millions and millions and millions of dollars that he was given in donations and gold and all of these kinds of things. And all of it went to charities. All of it went to help the country, or to build health centers and look after poor people and do development works and all of these kinds of things. And nothing went to build a big fancy monastery. And so to me, that's the ideal of a forest monk. That's how they should do.
Ajahn, just now one brother mentioned about this. It's actually about the foundation of the bhikkhuni and the Buddha's time. I think we all know that at first the Buddha rejected two times when under asked for Mahaprajapati Gosami to become a bhikkhuni. The reason is that if we have a bhikkhuni sangha, then the teaching or the sasana will get into half in the length of the time. I don't quite understand why the Buddha said this. Is it because probably the Buddha see the future and see the impact of it? Or what does it actually mean? I don't quite understand why the women in the bhikkhuni sangha can have that kind of impact.
Well, exactly. I think, you know, you've raised a very good point, and I agree with you. I also don't understand, and I think that, I think that it doesn't make any sense. Yeah. One thing, you know, it's important to consider is one of the things I'm a bit of a textual scholar. All right, it's one of the things that I do. It's a kind of hobby, and when you do sort of text scholarship seriously, one of the things that you notice is that very often when people read these kinds of passages, they just kind of pick them up out of context and without any reference to anything else, and just kind of read it in a very, very literal or very matter-of-fact way. This is just describing a bunch of events that happened, and you read it like you'd read an article in the newspaper telling you what happened in the parliament yesterday. Yeah, but it's not like that at all. Okay, it's a 2,500-year-old text, a religious scripture, and you know, we have to be humble and honest and realize that we don't really know exactly what happened. Right? So when we're trying to interpret these things, especially when things are problematic, we should look into a broader context. We should try and see how does this relate to other things that are said elsewhere. For example, when the Buddha spoke about what are the factors for the decline of Buddhism, right? This is something which is actually addressed in many suttas, not just one place. Yeah. So if you just read that one sutta, you think, oh, the Buddha said that bhikkhunis are going to end Buddhism. Actually, the Buddha said, and you think, wow, these bhikkhunis, they must be really tough. I don't know what they're going to do. Go around with machine guns and shoot all the monks. I don't know. How are they going to bring about the ending of Buddhism? But if you look right across the suttas, in many different places, it discusses the ending of Buddhism. And it never says anything like that. It always says things which are very sensible. And basically it says that, you know, when people are no longer practicing properly and when the Dhamma is no longer flourishing, that's why it will come to an end. And in particular, there's suttas that say if the bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, laymen and laywomen are practicing and have respect for sila, samadhi, panya, the training, and I think that's it, I think four things, sila, samadhi, panya, and the training, yeah, then Buddhism will thrive. So in that passage, the Buddha is saying that actually if there's a well-practicing bhikkhuni order, it's one of the factors for the long-lasting of Buddhism, right? So then you have to look at both of these contexts and you say, ask a simple question, which one is Dhamma, right? Which one is actually Dhamma, yeah? Which one is got that ring of authenticity and truth to it that sounds like this is something that the Buddha would say? And so of course, you know, to me it's obvious, yeah, this is the kind of thing the Buddha said all the time. Yeah, if the Sangha is practicing well, this is what leads to the long lasting of Buddhism. And to say that the entry of women is like a disease, you know, this is what it says in the text, and it's often it's glossed over. We don't like to pay attention to it because it's too hard to look at. Yeah, and remember, this is the Buddha's stepmother who's come up to ask for ordination. You know, she's like 70 years old or something like this. And she's just walked from Kapilavatthu down to Vaisali, yeah? And, you know, and she's begging with tears in her eyes that she wants to ordain because all she wants to do is practice to realize Nibbana. And the Buddha says, if she comes into the Sangha, it's like a disease which is going to destroy Buddhism. It's like the disease called red rot, which rots the sugar cane. It's like the disease called white bones that'll destroy the wheat crop. It's like a flood that will destroy all of Buddhism. You've got to think, this is weird, right? If my mum came to me and said, I want to become a nun, right? And I said to her, if you come and join this monastery, it's like a disease, yeah? What would you think of me? You'd think, oh, God, he's a bit strange, isn't he? Yeah. I mean, even if I didn't want her to join, surely I could find a more kind way to do it rather than using this kind of language. Yeah? So this is when we hear these kinds of things, then what we're actually hearing is this unconscious projection, these fears which are actually coming through in the text. It's not a recorded remark that the Buddha actually said. It's a projection, somehow, some unconscious fears and prejudices which are held within the Buddhist community, which find expression in that text. So my personal belief is that this story of Mahapajapati doesn't is not actually the story of the foundation of the Bhikkhuni order at all. I believe that it's the story of Mahapajapati's attempt to become a nun, and the tension that is in the text is a remnant or originated in personal difficulties with Mahapajapati herself. Okay? And to give this again some context, right? If you look at the Buddha and his family, yeah, many of the Buddha's family members were very problematic when they joined the Sangha. Yeah? We know about Devadatta, yeah, the Buddha's cousin, yeah, and there was many others. Upananda the Sakyan was always, he joined the Sangha and he was always kind of asking lay people, give me some robes, give me this, give me that, and annoyed everybody. There was Channa, the Buddha's charioteer, yeah, he had to have the punishment put on him when the Buddha was dying. There was the Baba, Upali the Baba, who asked that he ordained after all the other monks. The other monks asked if they could ordain Upali the Baba first, so that they could bow down to him to reduce, and it's what the text literally says, is to reduce our Sakyan pride. Yeah? And so in the Buddhist tradition, the pride of the Sakyans is notorious. Yeah? They're very proud people. And so I think what's going on here is that Mahapajapati is like one of the royal ladies of the Sakyans, and her son is the Buddha, right? Yeah, so you think how much pride she must have in the Buddha personally. There's one episode where she comes along and she wants to offer some robes to the Buddha, and she says, please, you know, accept these robes. Again, this is a very interesting story, because of course, what do you do? Like, if I'm a monk, if someone offers me some robes, what do I do? Well, you accept them kindly. If you need the robes yourself, then you take them. If you don't, then you share them with the Sangha, yeah? But this is the only time this happened. She offers the robes, and the only time ever in the whole Pali Canon, and the Buddha says, no, don't offer the robes to me. Offer the robes to the Sangha. Yeah? And again, she wants to offer them to the Buddha personally. And he says, no, don't offer them to me. Offer them to the Sangha. So if we ask psychologically what's happening here, then I think it's pretty clear. Is, you know, Mahapajapati feels that strong attachment to the Buddha. It's her son. Yeah, it's very natural. And he wants to make sure, because she's used to being in the upper class of society. She's used to having everybody do what she says. Yeah, and she's got that pride. She wants to make sure that the Buddha wants to make sure that his mother, his stepmother, respects the Sangha. Yeah, and so this is why he deflects it in that way. And I think it's the same thing at the request for ordination. The Buddha is actually concerned that when Mahapajapati joins the Sangha, that she'll have a lot of pride and she'll be very difficult to deal with. And so he wants to make sure from the beginning that she understands that she has to pay respects to the Sangha and be one of the Sangha, not somebody who's somebody special. And so I think originally that story was about Mahapajapati's entry to the Sangha. And personally, I don't believe she was the first nun, although that's historically it's very difficult to say one way or the other. But I believe that there is some suggestions that there are other nuns ordained earlier. Well, certainly it's the case that by the time the Tripitaka was edited and put together, obviously by that time it was universally accepted that Mahapajapati was the first nun. But whether or not she was actually the first nun or not, I think that story is really about her. It wasn't about the nuns in general.
So maybe Ajahn, moving forward, what do you think should a layperson do? I mean, we understand the history, we supported the Bhikkhuni ordination. Then moving forward, what is your advice to us? What should we do? And
You should go to Ayurpeka and ask her whether she's establishing a Bhikkhuni monastery, and ask how you can help her. Yeah, no, seriously, you know, and for Aya and the other Ayas, you know, many places around the world, in Australia, Sri Lanka, America, Germany, Indonesia, and people are setting up these monasteries, and they do have a difficult time. They have a hard time. So, you know, reach out to them, make your support known, and then see what you can do to help.
Maybe you'd like to share with us, Venerable.
Thank you, Bantai. I needed that. Well, it is true that the Theravada sisters really need help. I think that's the reason why I chose to stay in the brown robes and didn't want to go back to the grey robes. The main purpose was that if I can do something to help build more monastery, or even one more, because from the feedback that we were getting before I came back to Singapore, I was actually discussing with Bandis Chado that there are some monastics as well as lay people who actually, there were so many people who were actually coming over to Santi to try to see whether there's any chance of ordination. And I also have observed that those who actually went over to Burma or Sri Lanka and all that, some of them actually became very sick due to climatic differences or diet differences and all those things. So it was actually quite a sad thing to see that, you know, some of them have to drop out sometimes because of sickness and all that. So the decision actually was, if we can actually work together to hopefully establish another forest monastery in Australia. I mean, Brian White of the Buddhist Council of New South Wales actually contacted me, and he himself mentioned that he hopes to see it happen in Australia itself. And if it happens in Australia, then we can cater to all the Westerners from all parts of the world. There are many people actually nowadays, many people are coming forward, the Westerners, and they are very young and sincere, to many of them wanting to become bhikkhus and bhikkhunis. So the plan now is actually to try to either locate more. Actually, I hope to go to Sri Lanka too, because some Sri Lankans in Australia, in Sydney, those who have visited Santi, they have also recommended certain places in Sri Lanka. I hope that I can visit there too. So it will take quite a while, but it will be good, like in times of needs, you know, anyone who can support in whatever way you can, it will be very helpful. Right now, I think right now what we're trying to do is to establish another monastery which is similar to what Santi is doing, because I think Santi and Dhammasara in Perth, these two places actually are training bhikkhunis with the support of the bhikkhus, and from what I can see, much in line with what we see in the suttas according to the Buddha's recommendations. It's very pure. The Vinaya is very strictly followed. The dual Sangha are actually, respecting each other, as Bhante say, you know, giving autonomy and all those things. So we hope that there is another similar forest monastery built up in this area, even if it's in Sri Lanka. Because we have got feedback from the laity that, you know, there are, as one of the devotees was mentioning just now, that there are just so many monasteries in the whole world, but there are so few that actually accommodate the fourfold assembly, so few that actually practice the Vinaya and do meditation, or meditators given the proper support and all that. All these are lacking. So if somebody has a monastery or even a piece of forest land to offer, of course we'll be very, very appreciative of that. It will help to save a lot of effort on our part, and then we can, you know, establish it quicker. We hope that proper training systems and all that will be introduced and all that, and all the forest monasteries in Australia can work together, complement each other, and train future monks and nuns. And hopefully we can see more Arians in this world. Hopefully even Arahants, we will know, right? So we really do need your help. And I think our sisters, our bhikkhuni sisters in America now, that they are all coming together to also create this awareness about the plight of the bhikkhunis worldwide. So we hope that, you know, as nuns, being females ourselves, we really would like to do our part to help all our sisters. Yeah. It was only when I went to Santi that I realized that, you know, as a Mahayana nun, we really had it so simple and easy. As long as we have a pure intention to become a nun, we have lots of places in Taiwan to go for training, to go for ordination, and then you just get the recognition immediately. You know, there's you don't even have to worry about anything. You get all the support there. But it was only in Santi that I realized, oh my goodness, you know, the Theravada sisters are really, really facing a lot of difficulties. And there was... yeah, quite sad and painful. So I thought that, you know, as females, and also being a bhikkhuni myself, I thought that together with other monks like Ajahn Brahman, Bandhischa Ato, you know, they are actually supporting the bhikkhunis. So with their help, we hope that, you know, more can be done for the females. We won't know whether one of you may want to be a nun in the future, in the early near future, or even, you know, your daughters or sisters or whoever. So we hope that we can create a conducive place for them to be properly trained. So hopefully all of you will be able to help us when the time comes. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Keep us posted. I think definitely we will help to spread the words around. Any more questions? Brother sister, I think we find all the answer today. Okay, if not, maybe we should just close the session. But let's say sadhu, sadhu, sadhu three times. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.